Welcome, everyone. There's still some seats at the front, too. We're running a little late because the opening session went a little longer, but we're very happy to have you all here. This is the Hirschfeld Bar Panorama session on explicit content about sex, erotica, media, porn in archives and exhibitions. I'm very happy that so many of you came for this topic, and I'm very happy about the three presenters that we have here. Originally, this panel was planned in a different style, in a different format. Originally, there were seven presenters on this stage planned. Over the course of the last weeks, this has been reduced to three, which we're very happy to have these three here, and which gives them more time than originally planned for their presentations. But this also causes us to change the format of this session. Because originally it was planned, or to explain this maybe for the coming days too, the panorama sessions here in the Hirschfeld Bar normally are very short presentations in a TED-style talk of 5 minutes, and then you go over to the different tables and have the chance to individually, in small groups, interact and talk with the presenters. Now, imagine those three sitting with all of you on three tables. It would be very hard to have a conversation, so we've decided to change it and to have three presentations after each other, and then have a joint Q&A with all of you here in this in the audience, and someone will be going around with a microphone, giving you the possibility to ask questions and give comments. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce our first presenter, Mike Oliveira. He's a reference librarian and archivist at One Archives. He is going to present on Gale male erotica magazines from the 1970s and 1980s. And the title is, I Read Them for the Article. So,
let's make it a command.
Read them for the articles. And so, welcome, Michael.
Hi. Well, thank you very much. Whoops. Okay. Good. Thank you very much. All right. Hey. Okay. A little. Shouldn't encourage you too much. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for the opportunity. This is a wonderful experience. I originally didn't think about this, and actually I have to thank somebody in the audience right now, Kat Walker. We were talking about some things, and there was a sort of comment about EBSCO, a database company that had a large number of LGBTQ magazines and newspapers available online, over 500 of them, and some people in the States, in the state of Colorado, were protesting that, and I was thinking, well, what are they protesting? And so I did a quick search of Google, and this is what came up. And sorry, it's so pixelated. I was like, this is not what's on EBSCO. It's about news. I mean, I'm sure there's probably some ads, but EBSCO really did just focus on the articles. It was really done during the 90s, when the beginning of the digitization of LGBTQ newspapers and magazines was first started. So what are they complaining about? What are they finding? It's mostly news stories. And so I was very concerned about how are they going to capture the magazines of the 70s and the 80s where erotica, and when I define erotica as just nude males, nude females, is prevalent in all these news magazines. And there are so many of these that are incredibly important to documenting our history, at least I feel so. And I'm going to run through some of the short runs of magazines that really weren't... wait a minute. I've jumped ahead. I'm sorry. I'm going to talk about... here we go. This is how Alexander Street Press provides the information. And you can see here they have a little warning. This contains graphic content. So at least there's some warning. And basically the graphic content, which I'm sorry I didn't show you, you click on the link and then you get this. So, but I've got to give them credit because don't show this message again. which is fantastic. And I realize they're marketing to high schools and colleges and universities and public libraries. So I give them a lot of credit for doing this. But the erotic content is, you know, a woman with her shirt off. I mean, you see this on TV now, and I understand they have to market to the lowest denominator, the people that might be offended by any nudity at all. Oh gosh, I'm almost going to go there with the clothing thing. Anyway, so one of my favorite magazines, this was really a short run, about 6 issues got it right out of New York. I was going to say San Francisco. It really focused on, I'll probably mispronounce his name, Robert Blakely. But it was really some wonderful photography of nude males. And this is never going to make it today if we have to worry about nudity in the archive. And then there's this one, which apparently there was a huge button shortage in the 80s, in the 70s, because I guess we were concentrating on hair product. This is out of San Diego. It thankfully only lasted 2 issues. Thank you for laughing at that. But this was a really interesting magazine in the fact that it had a nude male centerfold, and then also in the few pages back, a nude woman. And so, I don't know, I guess their idea was that we'll sell it to everybody. It was an interesting attempt. It definitely is that out of the liberation idea of sexuality, nudity is not necessarily bad, but it didn't catch on. This one is out of LA. And what I want to concentrate on is that, oh, you can barely read it, but on the right-hand side, there's Dennis Cooper. Vito Russo is talking about AIDS. Motley Crue is being interviewed in a gay magazine. Okay, do you guys even know who Motley Crue is? You'll have to Google it later. It's really interesting to me that these type of interviews were taking place in gay magazines. And without these primary sources, what will people know about gay culture? And the extent that gay culture influences and takes part, is part of general culture overall, society overall. It didn't turn out too bad, but this was originally taken as a reference shot. Alternate, this was, again, another short run out of San Francisco, published 77 through 82. Later changed its name to Manifest and then became a newspaper. It's kind of messy overall. But these special issues that talk about art are just incredible sources of primary interviews. And if these things are not made available to researchers, to students, I think we're missing something. Because we're missing something through a gay lens or a queer lens. But really what I want to talk to you about is In Touch. This is sort of a sin of my own. This magazine was published from 1973 to 2003, more than 300 issues. How many of you have ever heard of In Touch out of Los Angeles? Oh, I love you guys. How many of you actually have any copies of In Touch? I know Gene does. So you know what? I believe it's only at 6 libraries across the country, and there's only one that has a full run. We'll make it 2 then, Gene. And this really got to me because it was really an amazing group of people that came together and an amazing group that was sort of very transformative. This is Jim Kepner writing. His articles are not even in the table of contents of the magazine. He talks about the issues of that period. You know, what is the gay community? He talks about pressure, one of the articles, I should say, talk about being a single man in the 70s, and he talks about cultural pressure to find a spouse in the 70s. And I was like, that's not what I think of when I think of the 1970s for gay life. So he talks about a lot of things that are not necessarily thought of as a general culture, because this has been removed, sort of erased, because nobody experiences this. Nobody sees this in any type of search. And then, of course, fashion. You know, when these magazines come back, we'll be wearing caftans, which will be a lot more comfortable in this heat, and, of course, maybe plaid caftans. But the one thing I really love about this image is the inclusivity. In all through In Touch, there are African-Americans, there are Latinos, there are people of other descents, there are other cultures, Asian-Americans, or Asians, I should say, in the magazine itself. Now, I understand that is not necessarily being in the boardroom. It is not necessarily being part of the editorial staff or a photographer or a writer. But it is something inclusive. Being just able to see yourself, I believe, is so incredibly important. This is about as rude as I get, or whatever you want to call it. Sorry, it's pixelated again. It was a reference shot. John Retchie, who wrote City of Night. This is an interview. It's a tremendous interview. He talks about how courageous, at that time, drag queens were. He talks about all sorts of things. But this, again, this is never going to be seen unless this is digitized, unless this is made available. It goes through a number of different changes. You have Mae West, Christopher Isherwood has some sort of Berlin comp, whatever. That was a bad joke. Wakefield Poole, Tab Hunter. They go through some changes here, but and then we get into this period where we're documenting our culture, the rodeos, and on the right there, science fiction. How important is science fiction in the LGBTQ movement? You go back into the 30s and 40s and 50s, and this is when science fiction is the way to talk about LGBTQ people. And so an issue like this on science fiction brings it into the present, well, at least brought it into the 80s. And a person by the name of Jim Yousling is the one that really was transformative in this magazine. He was part of the staff early on, became the editor. And Jim was interested in culture, and he really changes the magazine, gives us that wonderful IT logo. And he talks about our culture. He talks about music. He introduces that idea of homocore, queercore, into the public eye. His articles are actually lifted by J.D. the Zine out of Toronto and reprinted there. So this is one of the really amazing things. It's out there, and it's being shared until now, where it just disappears. Oops. This is definitely, sorry, this is way too small for you to read, but the musical groups, Specimen, Red Hot Chili Peppers, White Flag, Sisters of Mercy, Bitch, David Lee Roth, well, I don't know why he's there, Pyramid Club, John Sachs, it goes on and on across that cover. Talking about these groups, talking about their influence on culture, talking about them. And then on the right-hand side, again, Jim has left, but they start featuring people of color on the magazine. And I'm not sure exactly how I feel about that. These are nude images that are in the magazine, but at least it's a presence. At least it is somebody that is representative. Other magazines later on, like Advocate Men, just do a single black issue every year. And they're not, these are all people of color that are in these little inserts for about 2 years. So it's a really interesting look for me on the early attempt on inclusivity. To wrap up here really quickly, I'm wrapping up really early, sorry about that. Technology. This is one of the things that is really more like what is going on. In Numbers in Blue Boy, the first discussions, the first articles about AIDS, HIV are there. A person by the name of Don Volk, these are the transcripts of those interviews, are reprinted in those magazines. Well, this specific one is reprinted in Blue Boy. The discussion of these things to reach that audience that is most vulnerable to AIDS, HIV, what are people going to pick up? They're going to be subscribing to Numbers. They're going to be subscribing to Blue Boy. So just getting that educational information out was something incredibly important. Again, something that's going to be lost if there's not explicit, if there's not representation, digitization, making these things available. Always like to end with Kettner, the promise of gay liberation, whatever the changing styles and slogans of a particular era, is greater freedom, greater diversity, and a greater contribution to a richer world culture. We are only beginning to define ourselves, to measure our capabilities, and to find a sense of community. And I urge you to go out to your collections and see what is unexplored, what is not available. The companies, our representatives, are right out there, right now. Talk to them. Tell them about what you have. Share those ideas. Because we really need to have this stuff made available in whatever way. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I was especially intrigued by the attack of the giant glands. I would be interested to see what that was, and Darth Vader unmask. Explicit. Yeah, and I'm very happy to introduce our next presenter, Genevieve Flavelle. She's an independent curator, she's a writer, she's curated various exhibitions, she's also a PhD student at Queen's University, and she's going to talk about an exhibition. The title of her talk is Rumors, Gossip, and Ghost Stories, Contemporary Art Exhibitions in LGBTIQ+ Archives. Give a warm welcome to Genevieve. Oh, I just read the old title without.
Yeah, I changed the title because originally it was only supposed to be 5 minutes, so it seemed like a lot to talk about multiple exhibitions. So I'm actually just going to talk about one exhibition, which is Tape Condition Degraded, which was at the Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives. So yes, I will start. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. In the summer of 2016, I made the sweaty pilgrimage through a smog-stifled Toronto to see artist Hazel Meyer and historian Kate McKinney's exhibition, Tape Condition Degraded, at the Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives. Tape Condition Degraded was a site-specific show inspired by McKinney and Meyer's discovery that the CLGA, which I should mention has recently been renamed the Archives, and there's other talks by folks from there here as well, holds a collection of over 800 VHS porn tapes. Spending 2 years watching, rewinding, and reporting the condition of the tapes, the couple began to fantasize about their dream tapes, tapes that were homemade, kinky, featuring women, trans folks, people of color, and performers with non-normative bodies. Finding little to none of these dream tapes in a collection that was built through donation and is largely comprised of commercially produced gay male porn from the 1980s and 90s, McKinney and Meyer began to envision a different kind of archive, a multifunctional space for watching, digitizing, and getting off at the CLGA. Requiring visitors to duck through a jagged hole bashed into a false wall built over the gallery's usually generous entrance, this wall was once proposed as protection against police raids, Tape Condition Degraded did not immediately feel like an art installation. It didn't really feel like an archive either. It felt domestic, colorful, welcoming, kitschy, and secret and sexy. There was no customary vinyl on the walls proclaiming the title of the show, no works loudly declaring their status as art, and no densely packed archive stacks. Rather, the colorful space felt like one in which, depending upon the time of day you arrive, you could find people digitizing VHS tapes, drawing porn at the drafting table, or pulling out the video camera to shoot their very own tapes against the vibrant green screen wall. Various objects such as tools, props, contemporary artworks, archived party flyers, and newspaper clippings commingled in the space. The ways in which the objects were displayed were perhaps even more suggestive than the objects themselves. The setup of the exhibition as equal parts archive, digitization suite, pervy queer sex zone, and community recreation room invited embodied, erotic, and imaginative responses to the archive as a repository of not only knowledge, but also of pleasure and fantasy. Archives are inherently political. We know this. Representation matters. Porn is compelling as a form of knowledge and an archive in and of itself. I think it is important to highlight that porn as an erotic record is an archive of affect. In the introduction to porn archives, Tim Dean notes that, quote, only rarely is porn valued as a form of knowledge in its own right or as making a contribution to understanding the history of sexuality, end quote. He argues that in addition to archiving information, porn archives pleasure and sexual minorities can use porn as a form of cultural memory. This is why the CLGA has such a large collection of donated porn that continues to grow. People believe these tapes are worth bringing to the archive to be cared for, that they document something worth saving. Meyer and McKinney highlight that with tape condition degraded, they wanted to invite the public to, quote, encounter the CLGA's collection of porn and consider its status as a vital record of LGBTQ subcultures that is at risk as the archive moves its holdings online. So porn as an archive of pleasure, sexual subcultures, aesthetics, desire, it matters, and it deserves to be preserved, studied, and enjoyed. But what if there is no porn to archive? In the case of queer, trans, and lesbian desire, how can the absence of representation be grappled with? We know why this absence exists. Lesbians and trans folks have not historically had the kinds of resources and access that cis gay men have had, and therefore a reflection in the world of mass-produced culture is very slim. What Meyer and McKinney were looking for, kinky, queer, feminist, and trans porn with diverse performers, was not largely not commercially produced or widely distributed before the 2000s. As we search for material evidence of marginalized LGBTQ plus narratives, questions of how to address absence, difficult knowledge, and uncomfortable excesses become imperative. Artistic practice offers an avenue of discourse by giving form to absence. My current research focuses on exhibitions as avenues for constituting legitimacy and staging a plurality of histories. I'm interested in how artists are giving form to the unknowable, messy, and emotionally complex aspects of queer and trans histories. So rather than approach absences in collections or canons with what Eve Sedgwick has termed a paranoid analysis that is continually reaffirming the negative, or what Eve Tuck terms damage-centered research, which seeks to establish harm or injury in order to advocate for reparations, but ends up reinscribing one-dimensional depictions of suffering, my methodology is reparative and hopeful. My research, my larger research, considers not only what has been excluded from museums, archives, and historical narratives, but asks how might these absences be hijacked as productive points of departure for thinking and working beyond disciplinary boundaries. Taking up what Jose Esteban Munoz, his assertion that the aesthetic is central to the project of queer hope, my larger doctoral research focuses on how artists are generating additive strategies for representation. So in the case of tape condition degraded, I'm interested in how the exhibition deals with the archive, both as a specific location with a local history, but also the archive as a concept. The exhibition proposes what a queer archive might look like outside of the disciplinary logic of the archive proper, while also drawing on material specific to Toronto. It acknowledges the queer archive as a site of fantasy. These fantasies may include understanding ourselves, understanding our history, desires, and connecting to community. By constructing the exhibition as an atmosphere, Meyer and McKinney draw on common sensations of erotic desire and nostalgia for real and imagined pasts. Following queer traditions of world-making, the exhibition constructs a colorful, reparative cosmos of queer desire, by amplifying the archive's capacity to be a community hub and shared repository. Curator and scholar Johanna Burton notes that the growing trend of staging exhibitions as atmospheres is a response to the need to conceive of history differently. By allowing artworks, objects, and signifiers to be free-floating, viewers can create non-linear narratives. Burton, echoing Rosalind Krauss, argues that innovating form allows innovations in thinking. So Meyer and McKinney's experimentations in the exhibition's form were deeply connected to their creative research strategies. Borrowing from their technology, Meyer and McKinney described their research methodology as a daisy chain. So a daisy chain is a method of duplicating VHS tapes with several VCRs at the same time. As they describe it, the daisy chain is an imperfect method as each copy degrades in quality down the chain, but it is a method that works with what is available, making and remaking tapes with urgency. In the absence of actual dream tapes, in the absence of the actual tapes that they sought in the archive, Meyer and McKinney invited their community to contribute their own fantasy dream tapes. 11 artists and activists contributed descriptions of their dream tapes, which were made into a free publication for the exhibition. This booklet was illustrated with Meyer's signature black and white ink drawings to give the fantasy tapes form. The wider public was also invited to contribute their dream tapes on site within the exhibition, and a working VHS digital transfer station was available to digitize personal tapes throughout the run of the exhibition. So discussing queering archives, Johanna Maria Rodriguez reminds us that institutions are founded on divisions between legitimacy and illegitimacy, and it is thus imperative to, quote, challenge how legitimacy is established and the forms of power it serves and upholds. Our response to risks needs to be about generating promiscuous forms of knowledge production, responding with activist creativity and intellectual agility rather than efforts to conserve or canonize, end quote. Appropriate for an exhibition about queer sexual subjectivities, Tape Condition Degraded promotes promiscuous and imperfect knowledge production in the form of gossip, anecdotes, dirty desires, and collaboration. The dream tapes center fantasy as a generative method of approaching the absent and the unknown in the archive's holdings. Creating a space of potential, the exhibition as an atmosphere, activated what exists in archives but cannot be seen. As Ulrich Mueller writes, quote, things that are intensely felt but cannot be pinned down, iconographies of what could be under other political conditions, end quote. The dream tapes demonstrate an intense reverence for porn as an activist and queer survival strategy. They also recreate a version of the intimacy that porn brings to the archives by creating a different kind of record of personal desire. So I mentioned that the exhibition, while quite fantastical, was also very location specific. Oh, so this is one of the dream tapes. Hazel also made gifs of the dream tapes. So I've mentioned that the exhibition, while fantastical, was also very location specific. One of the most prominent characters of local lore that inspired and guided the exhibition was the activist Chris Berchel, referred to as Our Diamond by Meyer and McKinney. Berchel was a kinky, leather-loving lesbian who fiercely advocated for porn and the CLGA's collection throughout the feminist porn wars and censorship crackdowns in Canada. It was Berchel who actually proposed building the false wall at the archive to hide the collection from police raids. In their research on Berchel, Meyer and McKinney eventually found out in one of her obituaries that Berchel had made her own DIY porn. Their dream tape existed. It was not, however, in the archive. The film came to them after the run of the exhibition on Super 8 instead of VHS. Made in the 80s as a collaboration between Berchel and seven other performers who called themselves the Positive Pornographers, the 20-minute film is titled Slumber Party. This film is now at the center of Meyer and McKinney's ongoing research, which they are continuing to share publicly through performative talks and screenings. This is from their performative talk. I think the discovery of Slumber Party demonstrates the potential and value of alternative approaches to archive-based research and exhibitions. Thirza True Latimer argues that, quote, contending with historical erasures places special demands on feminist and queer researchers. They must view gaps, absences, and apparitions as historically consequential, end quote. Dealing with these gaps requires counter-archival strategies that are relational, that work to understand the orders of knowledge established in and through official archives. So by following their desire to see and know an archive that did not appear to exist, Meyer and McKinney opened new channels of discovery that did in fact find something they were looking for. I think this is a very queer way of working, queer in the sense, as Munoz describes it, a structuring and educated mode of desiring that allows us to see things differently.
Thank you, Genevieve. Okay, so we're going over to our third and last presenter, Ralph Masseau. Ralph Masseau is an ethnologist specializing in visual anthropology, and he's also a photographer, a video artist, and works with mixed media, and gives lectures and workshops. And he's going to present a talk on the artist Franklin Weber, and the talk is titled Bringing Bastille Against All, the Bastille Archives. And so before, when we were talking before, they both said, oh, we're on a session about explicit content, erotica, media, porn. We don't really show any explicit pictures. We're going to, the audience is going to be disappointed. And then Ralph said, well, I brought some pictures. So just to keep the tension up a little bit while we're waiting for these photos for the talk here.
All right. Okay. First I would like to express my gratitude for this invitation, because I'm going to introduce you to the work of an artist that is, I think, not known enough, because I consider him as a major figure. But because his work is considered as pornography, and of course I'm fighting against this little corner, I think he's much more interesting than that. So I will present you the work of Franklin Ballard Weber. He was called and known under the pseudonym of Bastille because he was born on the 14th of July 1929 in New Jersey. This is one of the reasons he decided to take this name, celebrating the French celebration of Bastille Day. He was an adopted child, presumably abandoned by a Jewish family, which is something that really pursued him his whole life. He studied in New York at the Pratt Institute and received in 1959 a grant which allowed him to sail to Paris, where he learned engraving with John Friedlander. Friedlander was a Jewish artist who had fled Germany. Frank felt in love at the time with France and decided to settle in Dijon, where he found also his lover. And he wouldn't get back, really. I mean, he went back, but actually he decided to settle in France because he was not so happy with the American way of life, which he would consider an air-conditioned nightmare, as Henry Miller said. He did all type of illustration for the French magazines and French gay press and the French press. And later on, he specialized in architecture drawings. For that reason, he was familiar with the reproduction of painstaking details in architecture and street scenes. at night, somewhat tired of the job, he would then retrieve himself and let his imagination roam more freely, and then he would draw for pleasure on scraps of cardboard. This is how he started the drawings and gouache paintings that we are going to see and for which he is known. The Bastille body of artworks actually really initiates at the end of his life when he was reaching 50. He was somewhat frustrated with the gay life of Paris, and he was feeling, the perception of his aging body was making him coming home alone, and that's the reason why I think he compensated in building his own little world with his drawings. He was not so happy also with what was coming up in the gay scene in Paris at the time. He was looking for more easygoing boy next door figures, and he was not happy with this playing in the bars and clubs. So this is the reason why the people we see in the drawings do not really fit in the gay scenes of the time. This is because of his drawings. That's how he discovered those two gay contact magazine from Sweden, Toy and Mr. SM. And through this magazine, he got in touch with people more known at the time, like Tom of Finland, Martin of Holland, the Rob Leather Shop and Gallery in Amsterdam, and the Feature Inc. Gallery in New York, where he eventually exhibited his works, and that's how it all started. That was a question of a moment in his life and the opportunities, and that made him work on those paintings and produce them and sell them. Unfortunately, in 1988, he was diagnosed HIV, and he died from AIDS-related disease on November the 4th, 1990. So the illness went terribly fast at that time, and nothing was legally done to organize his legacy. That's actually the problem and the reason why I'm here. Left also with no proper documentation of the work, the Bastille archives, which I have started with some friends who knew him or knew about him, slowly decided to collect from nothing, because we started really from nothing, to collect from galleries, from collectors, archives, all information, and above all reproduction from the paintings that were produced. But due to the thematic, a lot of them do have to do with scatology. Those paintings were actually hard to reach, because even the collectors were not so keen on letting them photographs and letting anybody know that they had bought them or collected them. So I tried to get in touch with the Hares, and of course it's the sister of Frank who is the Hare. She was unaware that Frank was gay. She was unaware that he had produced these drawings, and she was even unaware that he died from AIDS. She thought he had died from leukemia. That was leukemia indeed, but related to AIDS, of course. So I pretend that he had done, you know, views from France, and she gave me an authorization. But then through the lawyers, we realized that we wouldn't go very far with this. We had to spit it out. And when we did so, of course, she asked us to stop anything. And so until then, we can't go any further, because what I'm showing you now, I'm not supposed to show, you see, because they don't want them to be shown. About Frank and his work, if I can contextualize, that came then in the early 80s, and he was using the opportunity given by this decriminalization turn in France, and he started to do those drawings at the time. You know, it's all enmeshed in a moment, precisely. And through these drawings, he was also inventing his sexuality. That's really interesting, because he was experimenting. Looking at those magazines, he would see experiments. Actually, some of his drawings are called experiments, and he would try with tubes, with rubber, with all kind of material. He wouldn't really go to sex shop and buy fun or sex toys. He would go to the hardware shop and just use any kind of bits and things to try to connect with other guys that he would meet in the street or at the railway station where he was living. He was living next to the Gare de Lyon railway station. And he would pick up guys at night and bring them home. And then he would invent his own sexuality, discover enemas, etc. concerning eschatology, I don't think he really went that far. He was more toying with the idea. So, of course, in those drawings that are trying to push the limit, working on the limit, he was confronted with some anthropological issues like purity and danger, how to deal with respectability and acceptance, and the linking for objectness in a time where, of course, retention and cleanliness are tokens to socialization. He was also dealing with ethical problems too, put back in the time, you know, this idea of multiple contact, exchange of fluids, that was really in Gnau the moment of the onset of AIDS, where it became very complicated and dangerous, actually, to have this uncontrolled sex and exchange of substances. But he was also dealing with aesthetical questions, and I consider him more as a painter than an illustrator, which he was. I think his work as a gay artist has more to do with art as illustration. So he had to, actually, that's how it started. At the night when he was tired, he would start with sort of sketches, and he would admit that he was then masturbating. But those out of focus images would not satisfy him, so he would either get back and then put details, etc., to the extent of what we see here, those extremely detailed drawings. He would get his imagination also from art history. This is a representation which is really similar to the context that we've seen before. In these images also we see quote from the Templar order. These are the colors and the cross of the Temple order. You know, he would pick up everywhere, and he would go, of course, to museum and exhibition, and he would sort of invent his art and his sexuality. There is also some interesting drawings where we see those phylacteria with words, exchange of words, etc., balloons. There are some play also in the name of the paintings with the words, you know, slap, whip, flip, clip, trip. So it's a very complex work, all in all. So anyway, he was doing so much, getting so far into the details that he would end up with these paintings in the end, where he would say that he wouldn't find them actually sexually or pornographically functional, and he would laugh because he had a lot of humor. But that's really interesting because he was then reaching a point which is way beyond what everybody wants to reduce as him, and that's actually what I'm fighting for, you know. So concerning his political activity, he was not political as such. He wouldn't go to the gay pride, he wouldn't demonstrate. He wouldn't be like, you know, Georg Engem at that time, who was really great with his book. But he would do those drawings, and I think they speak for themselves, really. That actually, you can analyze them. Of course, we are working on that. And I'm not going to bother you with all this because, as you see, it's very, very complex. It goes very far with a lot of influences. He was also in this time doing those drawings because already there was a big hegemonic imagery going on through the magazines like the Tom of Finland. He has never met Tom, and he had contact with him. They were in very real, friendly terms. But he would not really like Tom. Tom wrote me that he said to him that his drawings, Tom's drawing, would not turn him on. So that's the reason why Frank was doing his body of work. And I think it goes probably very far because I analyze it as probably a kind of critical reappropriation of the body and taking care of the fluids, and eventually go as far as the body seen as a fleeting self, a vectorial fluidity. Do I have time still? 3 minutes, wunderbar. So anyway, he was, but of course we don't have the order now, so But then you get a look of what it is. I was looking for this punk guy. Of course, we're not gonna get it. Doesn't matter. So there's this punk guy with the harden, and he draw on the t-shirt of the young bloke those two arrows that are troubling actually the stiffness of the tumescence drive of the penis. He gave at the time he was producing those images three interviews: one to the French Gaipier, to a luxury magazine called Magazine, and to a fanzine, an industrial and punk music fanzine. So these are three valuable interviews. These are actually the only three interviews that he gave. What more can I say to you? Something which I think is important, because of course he was cornered in this pornographic corner, and then he would say no, because people can think what they want with what I'm doing, but for me, and I'm quoting one of the letter, I'm not one of those who can ignore the human being in front of them. So which means he would not reduce the people he was having sex with or even drawing as objects. That was the thing he was worried with pornography, which has to be discussed, of course, but it has to be put in the context of the time. He would not feel very easy with this idea of pornography. So, shall I conclude? Yes, I shall conclude, because I did it in a completely different order. So as a conclusion, I would say one could suggest the following. Rather than iconic and branded images like the Tom of Finland Foundation is trying to produce out of Tom's work in order to gain respectability and acceptance to the social contract, images that are plain and discriminate formulation of identity, the Bastille Corpus, the work of Frank Weber, of paintings, those paintings and drawings, suggest, in my sense, a more ambiguous and polysemic expression of the being in and with its relation to alterity. As Franklin Weber already in his time foresaw clearly sexual desire as a non-speculative experimental process of transitivity, where even the abject takes part and is fundamental, but not compulsory. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the audience was not disappointed to see some explicit pictures on this panel about explicit content. And the first question that came to my mind, especially your two talks, was the connection between them, the role of imagination in creating your own fantasy world, or your own pornography, your own erotic artworks or dream tapes in that sense. And I was wondering if thinking about queering memory, you talked about this in your talk, that imagining alternative old VHS tapes. I mean, that's how I understood it. That was, former VHS. What VHS tapes would I have liked to encounter? Could that be a form of queering memory, or also of creating alternative worlds when you're in your artworks as a way of creating a queer memory? Maybe you could talk a little bit more about these two aspects of imagination, or the role of imagination. And did any of these dream tapes get made in the end?
I don't know if they got made as images, right? The images of the tapes. But you can read them in the publication, which is on Hazel Meyer's website. And people approached the idea of a dream tape very differently, which was interesting to me. Some people wrote like straight up sort of erotic fantasies, like shot, like opening shot, this, and other people's were more poetic. Other people's were actually Cyrus Marcus Ware did one where it's like memories that they have from Toronto of like specific Toronto moments where like at like a party, like a lesbian sex party in like the 90s or something, like they wish that that was captured on their dream tape. So that idea of a dream tape and what is on the dream tape was very open, and I thought that was interesting. But I don't know if anyone made porn. Morgan C's contribution, which you could maybe see in one of my images, was she's a comic artist, like a graphic novel sort of artist. So she drew a comic strip of a fantasy dream where she wakes up in this sort of alternative porn world. She gets like sucked into a dream tape and encounters her like favorite porn star, who's a centaur, and takes her on this journey through the trans porn archives that, and like talks about why they don't exist and stuff. So yeah, like very creative and imaginative responses. And then the dream tape also that they did find, Bear Trails tape, they have been trying to figure out how to show that tape. They digitized it, but because it was on Super 8, so they've digitized it, but because it was made by this collective of people who all sort of had it was all of theirs, right? Like they all had authorship, and they had agreed to only show it if everyone agreed that it could be shown. They've been trying to figure out creative ways of showing it without showing it. So one of the ways that they're experimenting with doing that is through audio description, showing a out of focus version of it with audio description. So again, like a layering of fantasy and different way of accessing.
Well, you know, we have to put it back in context, as I always say, because we tend to judge from now, from what has been done at the time. Frank was starting from nothing. I mean, you know, he had lived a time where homosexuality was prosecuted, and then suddenly there was the upsurge of a kind of freedom. But he would think, but it all goes wrong. So he would have to say, and I have to show what I would really have if I ever had the opportunity to do and live and dream and fantasize as I do and as I want. So that's the reason why he started those images. But strange enough, like he was fascinated by rubber, the material, and then he would invent those clothes and outfit that were taken on later on by the gay businesses who started to produce those clothes. And that's really interesting. In some of the drawings, one sees that the guys are wearing caps, rubber caps. They were actually swimming caps that he had bought at the little shop around the corner. And then you would see appearing in the latex business from the gay community, those outfit in other colors. At the beginning, they were only black for what was existing. So what he has done, and then there is now something such as rubber culture in that we see at the Folsom Street Festival, for example. But these things would not exist at the time when Frank was doing his painting. So it was probably, you know, a forefront and an inspiration that was recuperated and marketed afterwards. But maybe it was also responding to a need in some way. But at the time, you know, there was no internet, there was no telephone, there was nothing, there was no Grindr at the time. That's the reason why he was working with those magazines where you would write to an Anzeiger and then you would get an answer 2 months after, you know. So it was really interesting to see that it started from nothing and it produces something that is really amazing and that in my sense goes way beyond just the reproduction of fantasies. It tells a lot about the relationship that we have one with another, and of course in the context of Frank's life that explains a lot, but it also goes eventually with relationship that we have with the earth, with everything. I go that far.
Okay.
No, because the American always, I mean, if I quote Tim Dean and his book on Gary Snyder, I mean, Americans do have a problem with this relationship to the ground, to the earth, you know, because it's not their land. They took their lands from someone else. So that's how we developed this. And it's really interesting because I think Frank also, as a Jewish guy, wouldn't want to live in the United States. Why? That was originally his country. I mean, he had no country. So where was the ground? Where was the Boden? Where was the soil? And the soil, then it tells a lot because all those clothes are soiled, in a way.
One question for you, Mike, or maybe that also connects, is because you talked about the content warning, like if you, of magazines online, and that they may prevent us from like all these kinds of interesting things that are in these magazines beyond the naked bodies and what we're being warned about in that sense. But I was wondering to highlight the fact that they're like. I mean, really interesting articles and contributions. How does that connect to the question of also getting off in the archives, is what I think you said, so that, I mean, not just saying they have merit because there's literature and, you know, academic worth in these magazines, but because they help people get off. And what do you think, that, you know, thinking about the acceptability that you talked about, does that... do we sometimes shy away from actually saying, well, you know, they have their value because they helped so many people get off in a society that did not show these sexualities?
What I was really trying to hit on was the fact that the warnings were at least there. And that way, the material was made available. And so in some way, I guess, I think probably the audience is probably following along here, in that the warning almost attracts people. I mean, it's almost like, oh, explicit, wonder what is in here. And I think I'm going to jump into something else. Excuse me here. How the body is depicted, how we are looked upon, what is the ideal body? Erotica shows us over time what you go back to cave paintings, go back to the 14th century, 13th century, go back to how women are depicted, go back to how men are depicted, what, you know, that, okay, I'm going to wait. Go too long. But anyway, erotica pornography shows us some sort of ideal. It shows us some sort of desire. And in each of these descriptions, it shows you what is erotic for one person or another. And going back, there's another magazine, which was just a regular news magazine out of Orange County. And one of our students pointed out on the front cover, it has an odd shadow under his left shoulder all the way down to his waist. And apparently the editor decided that he had a belly roll and they wanted it eliminated. They did it on the right side of his body, but they forgot to do it on the left. And therefore there is this Photoshop crop line clearly made, and now once a student had pointed it out, I show it to everybody, and they're going, oh, yeah, that's Photoshop. That's a bad Photoshop job. I would think that we really want these things made available because, you know, whatever and however you decide is erotic or fantastic or the potential, and that wonderful idea of using a blurred image allows people to put themselves into that image. And allows them to feel and make that part of their experience. And I think that is one of the wonderful things about our community, is the ability for many people to see themselves in whatever is out there, to experiment, to be beyond what is erotic. There's a group in Los Angeles called Avatar, and Avatar is a BDSM organization. And do you have any idea when it got hot? Anybody want to, when did Avatar start? When did this BDM group really explode? At the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And people go, why would it begin at the beginning of the AIDS crisis? This seems something terrible. This seems just so contrary to everything that they were talking about at the beginning of the crisis. Well, it's safe. It is negotiated ways in which people can interact And so all of a sudden, this idea of experimenting in different ways and different ways of having love and sharing that expression are really incredibly important to me and incredibly important to our community, incredibly important to the world. And I'm babbling on. So did I answer anything?
You did touch on that. Maybe to follow up on that, the question of the absences of the archive that you also talked about, so that they're at the archives that they were looking at, there is a lot of gay male pornography. I think most of us working in gay, lesbian, or LGBTQ archives, have experienced that discrepancy between those archives, and we cannot fill the gap. And I think that was what you said in your talk also, more like working with the absences. And I was struck by what you said, that the family who are the heir to them don't even know about this work that they did, but also that the collectors don't want people to know that the work is there. So there's also other forms of silencing and absencing, and it needs consolidated research to find these archives or recreate these archives. So maybe you could touch upon again on absences or how to deal with absence.
Could I just? I think. Yeah. One second. Yeah, sorry. I got. Yeah, sorry. This is one of those things that we constantly deal with as archivists, and I'm sure everyone in the audience has talked to some donor that has all of a sudden decided, "Oh, I don't want this story made public." It is one of these ongoing negotiations, and I do not know the magic answer, but if we make it clear that there is an absence in our finding aids, in our talks like this, I think that is one step towards it.
I just wanted to say that I had to go to collectors who were showing their pastel paintings in the toilet, and I had to photograph them in the toilet. Actually, it wouldn't work, so I had really to convince them to go with me to a place to have them photographed, but it was really, really complicated at the time. So, and they were gay guys. It was rather wealthy gay guys in Amsterdam. I mean, it could be anywhere. And I still have problem with Frank Lover, who is now an aging man. And I can't do much because, these are dirty pictures. And I don't know, it's already 30 years. No? I think now is the moment really where we can sort of push a little bit, but for a long time, they're just dirty pictures, and actually, they are not dirty pictures. That's what we have to convince. That's where we have to prove that it is much more than that. This is not fair. So, am I answering your question?
Yes. I think what this show shows is the power of sort of asking, right? Like asking these questions and putting them out in the open. And that's how so much research and archival things get found, right? It's like you would just ask around, like, do you have this? Does this exist? And someone maybe has something in their closet or knows someone who does or something. And that's how they found Fairchild's tape. It was one of the performers in it had actually stolen it from her before she left Toronto because she was showing it without the permission of the whole group. So that person just had it in their closet, and once it was being asked for, it came out. So I think sometimes, like with absence, we go, "Oh, this doesn't exist," that's the end of it. But really, maybe it does, and I'm interested in these creative strategies of pulling these things out, or if they really don't exist, like imagining what they did look like what did what would lesbian porn from the 70s have looked like, and I think those are really productive and generative ways of approaching absence. I look at it. I've done some research on a couple different things as well, but like. The film The Watermelon Woman, that's a great example, right? Like, it's a whole fictional film about archival research into this desire to see a black lesbian actress from the 1930s. And Cheryl Donnier, who made the film, like, created this whole fictional character and shot the photos with Zoe Leonard, and they made this whole archive that's not real, but is real, like, you know, has become real, has become this, like, real imagination and depiction of what maybe could have been, what it could have looked like, what that person's life maybe would have been. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you. I think good to open up the auditorium for questions from the audience. Maybe we have a microphone that's going to be passed around, so if you could raise your hand if you want to ask a question, and I'll take notes on who wants to say something.
Thank you very much, all three. I have a question for Ralph in particular, and I'm curious to hear more about the distinction that you made between Bastille's pictures and Tom of Finland's, and also the kind of, the way I heard it, the kind of ambivalence with which you're describing the pictures. On the one hand, you know, kind of claim the dirtiness of the pictures, but you're saying they are not porn, but there is something with the pictures that resists the pop commodification of Tom of Finland pictures. So I'm curious to hear more about this. And also related to that, perhaps interested in hearing more about the ass. It seems to me that the ass is very prominent or very distinct in these pictures. So I was just thinking whether you have some thoughts about that.
Just on the ass, he wouldn't only draw dirty asses, and I don't think he really get as far as being involved in eschatology. Martin Aboland testified that in some archives that are in New York, because he would say clearly that he had the fantasy of a very clean ass, like a science fiction hall. So that's really interesting. Going back to the commodification, well, you know, it's hard to sell shit. You have to transform it in something else. So these drawings, they still ask the very questions, who we are and who do we relate to the earth and everybody. And also Frank would say, you know, gay guys tend to pretend that they are very nice and they have very good taste and they live in a nice environment, etc. But it's just to make everybody forget that they are putting their dick in an asshole that is not always clean. So these are kind of things. The two had very good relationship, Tom and but they would just not. Tom had great respect for Frank, but Frank had also respect as a person, but he wouldn't like the drawings because he would find them too sleek, and he would find them too, because he was an illustrator from formation, so he would know, of course, all the tricks of the commodification business. And what we see coming from the Tom of Finland company now, for example, is exactly, you know, this marketing of an image. I mean, I don't think you can market Bastille. I mean, he was trying to find ways, so he was sort of putting not so much dirt, but as, you know, more displacement, so which is much more interesting, as Mary Douglas studied in her book. I think it's really interesting, this idea of displacement. Because he was also, of course, as you see in some of the drawings, very interested in science fiction. So it's always the question of a place. So that's why I say they are out of place. They are in kind of realistic environment, which they are not. And the guy do have their eyes closed. Where have they taken drugs or not? We don't know, but it's not important. What is important is that they are there, but not quite there. It's always this, you know. I think he was trying to find ways to gain a freedom, because he would see that what was going on with this imagery at the time, it was going wrong for him. I mean, we can discuss that, but for him, he was unpleased with that. He would actually regret the time of, you know, the toilets and the secret encounters at night in the parks, etc. So it was a kind of reaction to this upsurge of bars and clubs and magazines and things. He was actually very critical about that. So I don't know if that can be used. Well, probably everything can be used. Even shit can be sold. Artists have tried that, so and it works. So I don't know. Maybe there will be some sort of dirty clothes sold or dirty looking clothes, which actually happens. You can see them in the streets sometimes. So I don't know. But in the idea of Frank, it was really this displacement, this slipping from identity and a situation of the body. Am I answering your question, or there was another part of it? But it's really interesting because that's why I compared the two, because they knew each other. So they never met, unfortunately, but they knew each other. They talked to each other over the phone. But it was really a kind of fight of the titan, I would say.
Yeah, and what you were just saying there about it being kind of a way of advertising fecal material and everything like that kind of goes back to what you were talking about. But interestingly enough, when you mentioned all the different magazines and everything like that, you totally forgot about Flyover Country. And there were some very major pornography producers in the center of the nation, and when they would do articles, they were articles on how to find out if your phone is being tapped by the FBI, how to photograph nudes, how to, they were all very, very practical things, you know, and so they were advertisements. But even more so, after the end of World War II, European pornography, they discovered that the best way to advertise anything you wanted to get out that maybe wasn't so hot on the magazine stand, and I'll give you a really good example. Say it's the 5th Congress of Human Sexuality, or even gay and lesbian sexuality. And these are the conference notes, and they've been printed for everybody to see and read. You put that on the newsstand, and nobody buys it. However, you put it on the newsstand with a picture of a naked boy on the front cover, and you sell a ton of them. And they did that very, very much. And anytime they wanted to get something out to the public, just like those magazines from Flyover Country in the United States, if they wanted you to know something, if you needed to protect yourself from the FBI and wanted to know if your phone was tapped, you could go out and buy that. But that picture of that beautiful young man or that beautiful boy or whatever it was on the front cover is what sold it. And so it was used as an advertising mechanism long before any of this other stuff, you know. And all the magazines you mentioned were good and nice and everything like that, and we have most of them in our archive back, you know, thing. Toy, for instance, you mentioned the Swedish magazine. I think we have only one copy. It's rather hard to find and get, but they were used, and they were used as advertising, and that's how the magazines made money. That's how they could go on and make printing. One other thing, if I may, another example about...
Make short.
Oh, okay. Well, it was just that we had a researcher come in that was doing research on gay gangs throughout the United States, and he found out that most gay gangs had tattoos somewhere on their body. And he came through and went through all of our pornography, and the reason was is because when they put tattoos in their body, it wasn't just in their arm or on their shoulder, something like that. They could have them any place in their body, and by going through all the porn, he was able to find the tattoos that were a little bit more hidden, and that was just a way of the gangs advertising themselves.
That is an excellent point. The whole idea about tattoo art is just an amazing other especially in the physique photography, often you can identify people by the tattoos, what they might have been involved with, and then, of course, some physique photographers actually put tattoos on their models to make them sexier. But what you're saying about covers is really amazing. Probably could talk for half an hour on this, in which we recently had a person doing a graphical, a zine, and they were talking about zines, and his publisher insisted on putting this really beautiful boy on the cover, and the zine had nothing to do with the beautiful boy, and it sold really, really well, but he got lots and lots of hate email because it was like people bought it, and it was like, there's nothing about this guy inside. And even a copy of In Touch has someone on it, and there's no one in there. But yes, in order to sell, in order to make money, and so many people have not talked about erotica really funding political change. You go back to Falcon Studios. The money that came in through Falcon actually helped fund many of the Democratic campaigns in the state of California and nationally. And I think that is still something that is out there in which money funds change. How you go back into the 50s, Hal Call was basically a pornographer that ran Mattachine. And that money that came in created change. It flew the people to Minnesota so they could fight the court case to allow the publication of erotica. Showing a male nude with an erection was illegal. Showing a male nude was illegal until these cases came through. And without the money from erotica sales, that change would not have happened, or it might have happened later.
Okay, so we have time for one last comment or question, maybe not from a cis man this time, so that would be wonderful. Any question, comment? Wonderful, back there.
I have a question for... What's your name?
Genevieve.
Do you have any explanation why lesbians or bisexual women never want to make something explicit? I think you said something like, oh, it's a good idea to blur and then you can do your own fantasies. And I think it's so, a missed chance that everything, I mean, always... you see the back, or not the face. Mm. Do you have any explanation why that is?
I mean, in the specific case of that film, they're choosing not to show it.
No, I mean, everywhere, anywhere.
Everywhere. I mean, I think
always.
I think there is actually, there is explicit lesbian and like made for queer women porn and erotica. And I was going to mention, actually, in terms of what you were talking about, digitizing all of these magazines, On Our Backs, which was a lesbian erotic publication from the 80s and 90s, and they also made porn. It just wasn't like widely distributed. It was distributed by mail, like you subscribed, right? Had a very specific viewership. It was digitized a couple years ago, and there was pushback from the community about it being digitized, actually, about this small-run publication with a lot of like homemade DIY porn that people were submitting to a what they knew was a small audience being put on the web. And it actually got taken down, so it's no longer on the web, and you have to still go to the archive to see it. So I don't know, like there are ethics. So I think this stuff does exist. I think that there's not, like I wish there was so much more of it, but it does exist and we're still finding it maybe. Maybe it's not on the web or it's not being shown in the way that we necessarily want or we think is ideal because of the sort of like ethical implications of it and of consent. With and around explicit material, right? So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question. But.
We're very short on time.
Well, I would call archivists to really question what the ethics are there, that I think archivists should push for On Our Backs to be online, and that argument that shut it down, I think is something we should examine. It wasn't just a mimeograph zine that was sold in bookstores, so this argument that, oh, we had no idea that other people would see it doesn't fly with me. So.
I wish it was still online, personally. Like, I would like to see it. but that's just giving the example of what happened there. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, all three of you, for your wonderful presentation. Thank you for your attention.